Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Nareit's REIT Report podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Bork from Quito, and today we're looking at ways to develop an effective investor narrative, including best practices for resonating with generalist investors. My guests today are Jonathan Keener and John Rowe. Both are partners at public relations firm Joel Frank. Welcome to you both.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. This is Jonathan Keener. We really appreciate being on.
And this is John Rowe. Thank you as well.
Great. So before we get started, I'd like you both to give our listeners a brief overview of your backgrounds, starting with Jonathan.
Sure. So this is Jonathan Keener. Again, I'm a partner at Joel Frank. I joined the firm in 2012. By way of background, I got my start out of college in 2000, working in real estate investment banking, first at DLJ, the old Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, subsequently Credit Suisse, and after a few years as an investment banker in the real estate side, I actually went over to become a financial reporter and spent about a decade as a journalist covering a variety of industries, including real estate. During that time, I was published in the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, and ultimately wound up at Bloomberg, where I led their restructuring coverage through the credit crisis from 2008 to 2012. Subsequently came here to Joel Frank, where I help oversee our real estate practice.
And this is John Rowe. I took a very different path to being a partner here at Joel Frank. About 20 years ago, I got my start through corporate governance and management consulting, working at McKinsey & Company, but my client was actually a firm called Enron in Houston, which was an interesting place to be and an interesting time to be there to see the firsthand birth of the whole governance revolution, or at least the acceleration of it. Along the way, I've been at an institutional investor doing stewardship and investing in firms, and also been most recently at ISS, where I spent 7 years, most recently as the head of ISS Analytics, the data and intelligence arm of ISS. And I've been here at Joel Frank now for just about a month.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you both. Now, my first question is about the ways in which REITs can increase generalist investor interest, and what are some of the ways that they can attract capital from that cohort of investors?
Sure. So this is Jonathan Keener. You know, it's a great question. And obviously, your member group represents a wide, wide variety of companies in terms of market value, you know, industry, et cetera, et cetera. I think, however, on a very generalist basis, what you find with the REIT community is there's a real disparity between the dedicated investor group and the generalist group. And one pattern we tend to see with some of the REITs that we work with is they exist a little bit in an echo chamber where each earnings call, each, you know, major corporate development, where whether it's an acquisition or a disposition or launching into a new strategic, you know, vertical, they wind up becoming incremental. And instead of using the opportunity to retell their story and to introduce themselves to a new audience, they wind up sort of adding onto the prior dialogue. And what we find is that can really create a wall where a generalist investor has a hard time getting in. It's evidenced by investor decks that wind up being 30, 40, 50 plus pages long that really sort of become just sort of, again, an incremental build on what the company had done previously. It's evidenced on earnings calls when, you know, the executive team jumps in and just sort of launches in a very granular basis into the business and doesn't take the time to introduce an audience as to where the company operates, you know, what differentiates it, where the space itself may go. So we like to sort of hit the reset button and say, if I've never heard of your industry before, if I'm not a REIT investor, what's compelling about you? And one thing we say to our clients a lot is, look, REITs have a huge asset. They don't make widgets. You know, they invest and own and operate buildings. The great thing about buildings is they're very tangible. I'm sitting here in a conference room looking at hundreds of them across the East River right now. You know, these are great storytelling devices. And what we can do is leverage buildings, we can leverage products, we can actually work constructively with the media, with your analysts, and we can tell a story that is very tangible and can be very compelling to an audience. So to me, it's a little bit about hitting reset. It's about introducing the story and making it compelling, and it's about leveraging the exciting aspects of a portfolio to draw in a new audience.
And other than the big institutions and hedge funds, are there other opportunities out there?
Again, it's a great question, and it's obviously very specific to a particular investor base, but again, to sort of draw it back to a broader theme, I think one thing we see is that REITs are increasingly wed to whatever industry they're specifically relating to. So whether that's healthcare, whether that's logistics, whether that's industrials, whether it's office, REITs provide an alternative path to exposure to some of these industries. And I think that's part of the missing piece of the pie. So lots of our REIT clients will attend a NAREIT event. Lots of them will attend the big real estate conferences, but fewer of them will attend a conference sponsored by a media outlet, for example, Bloomberg or Dow Jones, that's focused on a specific industry like healthcare or logistics, et cetera. So one thing we try hard to do with our clients is to leverage their story away from simply bricks and mortar into a more thematic narrative that ties into the industry that they're connected to. So that to me would be one type of audience that isn't necessarily being tapped that could be through a strategic communications plan.
And in terms of investor relations, where are some of the key areas where you think REITs could improve?
Sure. So it ties back a little bit to the prior two answers from my perspective, but certainly kind of hitting reset and thinking about the dialogue as being introductory and pulling in a new audience as opposed to communicating with the established or existing audience would be the key. Secondarily, I think that, you know, one of the things we recommend all of our clients do is take a fresh look at their IR exposure. How often are they on the road? Do their independent directors ever go on the road? How frequently are they appearing at conferences? When they appear at the conferences, what is their approach to taking meetings? So I think it's sort of doubling down on the existing investor base and then thinking creatively about ways to engage with a new investor base.
Now, I understand that ESG factors can impact voting, but do they really matter when it comes to investment decisions at big institutions?
Yeah, this is John Rowe. And yes, it can make a big difference when it comes to investment decisions at institutional investors. You know, going back 5 or 6, 7, 8 years ago, governance was something that a lot of institutionals were nervous about when they looked at REITs. REITs were Maryland incorporated. There were features from a governance perspective that made them nervous. I think REITs have done a great job of overcoming that perception over the last 5 years or so. But now ES of the ESG, I think, is becoming even more important as we see more and more assets move into index or passive strategies, which are what these big institutions are largely funneling investments into. You know, it's been an interesting trend that we've seen institutional investors go through over the past several years. First, there was the big flow from active managers into passive managers. And then once that flow slowed, the passive managers competed with each other. The first competition was on fees, and we saw fees race to the bottom. And now a lot of the competition among the passive investors is actually by fulfilling different ESG objectives that the underlying investors may have in mind when they invest their money, trying to look for socially responsible investments or investments that cater to the interests that different classes of investors may have. So what we see investors doing is using ESG data to screen out potential investments. In some cases, some REITs get screened out, or to tilt investments sometimes based on the ESG performance and reporting the different companies give. So, you know, back to your question, does ESG matter when it comes to investment decisions? It's having more and more impact every day.
And everyone seems to be talking a lot about engaging with index funds. What do you consider to be some of the best practices?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, I just got done using the word passive when I was talking about the index funds. But when it comes to proxy voting in particular, these passive funds are anything but passive. You know, what is the best practice? Generally, it's to reach out to your shareholders every year. And sometimes companies do a great job of this, particularly when investor relations is reaching out to the analysts and the portfolio managers that cover their companies. But sometimes they don't do a great job. And a lot of times that's when they're looking at the index funds and trying to understand the stewardship teams, the people that are doing proxy voting and monitoring ESG at these firms. So, you know, the first best practice is understand that there are two different constituencies that your shareholder engagement efforts should be reaching out to. First, the investment professionals, and for the most part, companies are doing a great job at that already. But secondly, the stewardship groups. when you think about engagement, when you go to your IR department and you ask for a list of shareholders for engagement purposes, they should give you a list back. That list should have two columns. The first column should say investment professionals. The second list or second column should say stewardship or voting professionals, because that's the constituency I think that gets lost a lot of times. Other best practices, you know, one, don't get frustrated when you get a very, very small number of responses to your engagement efforts. You know, time has shown that maybe 15 or 20% of your invitations will get picked up. That's normal. But know that making the invitation to your shareholders is like putting pennies in a bank. It's making the effort, and investors are tracking those efforts to engage with them. And should you ever run into a situation where you have problems, being able to pull pennies out of those banks with shareholders is going to be a really nice thing to be able to do. And the last thing I'll say on best practice for engaging with index funds, particularly around ESG issues, is don't treat it as an IR presentation. Engagement teams generally don't know that much about your business and business strategy, and they don't want to spend 30 minutes understanding your AFFO. What they really want to do is understand what you're doing from an ESG and stewardship perspective. Make sure you're addressing those issues when you're engaging with those index funds.
Continuing on that theme of engagement, I wanted to ask if passive funds will really take meetings with smaller companies, and what should a small company do if their top shareholders decline opportunities to engage?
Yeah, well, I'll take the second part of that question first, which is don't give up. Make sure that you keep going back year after year and offering to engage. But the first part of your question, you know, will the funds take meetings with smaller companies? The answer is absolutely yes. Let's take BlackRock as an example. BlackRock's fantastic. They publish an engagement report every year that details what engagements they're having, what topics they're engaging on, how many companies, and in many cases, which companies they're engaging with. So in their 2019 engagement year, they engaged with about 1,500 companies. And these range from the mega caps, the names everyone knows, down into very, very small companies that requested engagement with them. And they rotate their engagement year to year. It's not always the same 1,500 companies they engage with year to year. So, you know, your large investors are trying to have meetings with smaller companies, but it may take you 2, 3, 4 years of reaching out to get a meeting with them. By the way, if you reach out and you have a pressing issue and you don't get a response the first time around, ask again. The investors are generally pretty good about recognizing that multiple requests in a single year may alert them that something's going on, and you may have a critical reason that you need to talk to them. And in many cases, it works.
Small and mid-cap companies need to take independent directors on a roadshow, even if there's no compensation issues.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that companies get wrong sometimes. They think that engagement always means a director. Engagement does not always mean a director. In fact, if I think back over time, what fraction of engagements do you actually need a director to be there for? It's probably no more than a quarter of all engagements, particularly when there's not a compensation issue. Now, look, there's exceptions. If you have an executive compensation issue, putting your C-suite people in front of shareholders is not the right thing to do. You need to have a director there. If there's a concern about company strategy, vision, direction, then you probably need to have a director there. But if you don't have one of those high-profile issues, you probably don't need to have a director there every year. Now, once every few years, is it good to put a director in front of your larger investors in particular? Absolutely. But once every 3 years, once every 4 years, when it's ordinary course of business type engagement, is probably more than enough. You don't need to take your directors on the road every year for every meeting.
So turning to shareholder activism, we've seen an increase in that lately, and I'm wondering what you see in terms of the longer term, in terms of that trend subsiding.
Sure. So this is Jonathan Keener. It's a great question. I think when you look at the velocity of real estate activist campaigns, so I'm using a slightly nebulous definition sort of involving REITs and operating companies in the real estate space, what we see is sort of a bell curve. Starting in kind of 2011, 2012, you had 19 campaigns in the space. That ticked up all the way to 41 in 2015 and then ticked back down to 16 in 2018. So again, you're kind of looking at a perfect bell curve from 11, 12 up to 18. You know, that made a lot of sense to us as sort of advisors in the space. And just to be clear, Joelle Frank only works with REITs and companies facing activist campaigns, never with the actual activist firm themselves. I think what you saw was an industry that perhaps lagged kind of the broader market when it comes to governance enhancements, you know, some of the issues that activists tend to target. Part of the reason for that, I think, was there were some perceived barriers to activism, looking at, you know, ownership thresholds, MUTA, et cetera. But you had a couple very high-profile campaigns in 2011, 2012, where the activists were largely successful. That sort of led to the floodgates of this peak in kind of this bell curve, which, again, was 2015. Those numbers started to trickle down, largely because I think REITs started doing a lot of the kind of self-policing that we see in the industry, where they start to look at their own governance, their own boards, and take kind of, you know, what I call corrective or best-in-class measures. And, you know, correspondingly, you see less campaigns. What's very interesting about that curve is 2019, we saw an uptick. We've actually gone from 16 campaigns last year all the way up to 24 this year as of today. But as we know, we're only in the early part of the month, so may well see a couple more now that proxy season has begun. What that represents to me is something perhaps a little different from simply, you know, there were companies that were vulnerable due to governance structures. What I think you now see is the existence of REIT dedicated activist firms. And that's a little different from a firm that might target a REIT, you know, if they saw an opportunity. What you now see are firms that really, you know, by definition have to pursue a handful of REIT activism campaigns per year because that's really what they specialize in. So for them, it's almost as much about marketing who they are and what they do as it is about an actual sort of value creating proposition. So I think that can be quite confusing to some of the firms that we work for because they'll look at the activist, you know, campaign and say, gee, you know, none of this is new or none of this makes sense or none of this is even actionable. And the response is, quite frankly, we've now created a bit of an ecosystem where, you know, these firms have to go after you, whether it makes sense from a P&L perspective or not. And that's where comms can really play a key role, I think, because a robust communication strategy, the ability to communicate effectively with your key audiences, first and foremost shareholders, analysts, media, et cetera, that's really going to be your best defense against, you know, some of these campaigns that I would view as more reflexive and perfunctory than actually value-driven. But yes, I would agree. I think we saw this sort of curve. You know, we saw a real trough last year, and we seem to be having a very active year this year with almost twice as many campaigns thus far into the year.
Right. Now, finally, I wanted to ask your thoughts about M&A in the REIT space and whether you think that consolidation is inevitable. And maybe what level of interest you're seeing from private equity?
Sure. So, you know, obviously we are just a communications firm, so any perspective we have on M&A would be purely anecdotal. That being said, you know, there does seem to be a drive towards consolidation. There seems to be a lingering concern about, you know, how long in the tooth we are in the credit cycle, in the real estate cycle, et cetera. You know, there does seem to be, you know, what everyone has read, this sort of, you know, vast amount of dry powder sitting on the sidelines from the sponsor side. You know, we're also seeing, you know, new types of entrants looking to acquire U.S. commercial real estate, obviously seeing sovereigns, foreign pension funds, et cetera. So, yes, it seems to be a very robust market. Consolidation does seem to have drivers. Again, I think, you know, the best way to not get caught up in a rush towards consolidation is to have a clearly differentiated story that really stands on its own and, frankly, to break out from that dedicated pool into a more generalist investor pool because that's ultimately going to be the thing, I think, that says to the world, this is why my REIT should exist. You know, this is why we should be here and this is the role that we play going forward. So tying that narrative to broader economic themes, demographic themes, technological themes, whatever's relevant to your company and pulling in that audience, we really see as the best way to differentiate and break through, you know, what might be an increasing push towards consolidation in the space.
Great. Jonathan and John, thanks to both of you for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed what you heard today, please visit iTunes either to subscribe or leave a review. And if you want more information on REITs, be sure to visit NAREIT's website, REIT.com.